Welcome to the University of Texas at Dallas. My name is Jim Murdoch. I'm the program head of the economics program in the School of Economic, Political, and Social Sciences, or EPS. The School of EPS is hosting this conference, this forum. What we have here are five professors of economics, all with advanced training, in economics. They come from different locations on campus. What we're going to do is let the professors talk for 3 or 4 minutes each, give you any perspective that they want. None of this has been scripted or planned. They may engage in a little bit of give and take. They may not. And then we'll open it up for questions. And the way we want to do the questions is have you fill out one of these cards. And if you raise it up, one of our people will come pick it up and they'll bring it down to me, and I'll ask as many questions as I can. We basically have the room for 1 hour, so we're pretty constrained on time. I want to go ahead and introduce the panel. And I'll start over here on my right, on your left. We've got Chetan Dave, who's an assistant professor of economics. Nathan Berg, associate professor of economics. Ted Day, professor of finance. Stan Leibowitz, professor of economics. And Rachel Croson, professor of economics. Chetan and Nathan are from the School of EPS. Ted and Stan are from the School of Management, and Rachel has a joint appointment. So we're covered. Chetan, why don't you go ahead and start?
Sure. So thank you everyone for coming. Welcome. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna talk a little bit about the macro aspect of current events. I am a macroeconomist by training and by passion as well, and these are, you know, interesting times. So I'll lay out the macro aspects of these things. I'll start with a little bit of a historical take, discuss the sort of macro impacts, or just sort of point them out, and think a little bit about some of the proposed legislation that's been floating around in Congress. And my objective is not going to be to lay out my opinions, otherwise we'll be here for like 6 years, okay? But it's going to, my objective is basically going to be to think a little bit about what we know in macro, and therefore what can we analyze as far as current events goes. All right, so the point of a financial system as far as a macroeconomist is concerned is effectively to take all of our savings that we all individually hold and, you know, aggregate them into possible loans that can be given out to firms and sometimes consumers. And basically to make sure that, you know, that process operates as fluidly as possible, right? So for example, if we all put our money together in a bank and a firm comes along with a good plan for starting up a business or expanding one and so on and so forth, and they need to borrow some money to get the latest technologies and whatnot, they can do so, right? And what that does is allows a little bit of growth to take place, well, sometimes a lot of growth to take place, as far as our national income, if you want to call it that, is concerned, or real GDP is concerned, if you will. So, with respect to that, what usually happens is that if there are issues in the private sector, they get reflected on equity markets like the Dow and the S&P and whatnot, right? So that's why we usually consider Wall Street, not a place, but a state of mind, if you will, to be like a leading indicator of what's going on in the real economy. There have been rare circumstances where there have been issues in Wall Street that have affected effectively Main Street, okay? And they're relatively rare, and there is a certain degree of suspicion that this is one of those times. I'm not gonna say that it's confirmed by data or anything like that, but there's a bit of suspicion with respect to that. And keeping sort of that in mind, a little bit of, you know, a story as to how we might have potentially gotten here, right? And once again, since we're in the middle of it, we don't
have sort of full analysis, but you know, this is what might have happened. In the late 1990s, to be precise, in 1999, there was an act that was made by, I think it was called the Graham-Leach Act, which basically undid the Glass-Steagall Act, which had been in place since the Great Depression, which had basically put a wall in between conventional banks, brick-and-mortar banks, and investment banks. And what removal of that particular act via the Graham-Leach Act, what that effectively allowed you to do was there was increased freedom to create these new assets and these new sort of investment vehicles, oftentimes as a function of people's mortgage payments. Now, also in the late, more in the early 2000s, but definitely in the late 90s to a certain extent, you had a prevailing environment of quite low interest rates, and mortgage lending rules that were relatively lax, if you will, for lack of a better term, and you know, through mortgage brokers and whatnot. And at the same time, housing was taken off. You see, housing prices were taken off. So there were lots of new mortgages, and some of these mortgages were based on bad credit, and then these interesting new mortgages, 100% finance mortgages, adjustable rate mortgages, interest rate only mortgages, and all these sorts of things. And what investment banks effectively did was pooled all these mortgages together and created new assets out of them, and both good credit, bad credit kind of a thing, cut up those sort of, the one pie that they made, if you will, and sold off the pieces. Well, over time, people who held those assets, institutions, big money investors, and so on and so forth, begin to realize that, they might have been exposed a little bit to sort of more risk than they thought in terms of what their exposure to this bad credit and whatnot was. And of course, interest rates started to adjust. And as soon as that happens, sometimes mortgages go bad, all these sorts of things take place. Financial intermediaries, specifically banks, who have the money to lend, don't feel comfortable lending, right? And when they don't feel comfortable lending, consumption falls, investment falls, real GDP falls. And that's effectively sort of the macro story. And we can talk a little bit, I think, later on about other aspects. So.
Thank you, Chetan, Jim, attendees. So listening to the radio, watching the news, just trying to use economic theory to grapple. This session was billed as a grappling session, so grapple we will. The first thing I don't understand is why is there such imminent need for action across the political spectrum, from left to right, in the assumptions of the questions that many of the reporters are asking that you hear. The implication is that we all agree that sudden action is necessary. A time bomb is ticking. Well, to me, the evidence for that is far from obvious. And in fact, if you start thinking through the economics of this, it tends to suggest quite the opposite, that in fact, no intervention and possibly an announcement that we should do no bailout at all might in fact be the best thing for rapid repair of the distressed sections of the economy. And I want to give a few theoretical explanations from microeconomic perspective as to why. I just mentioned in passing another, you don't hear this critical voice too often in the news recently, but just 3 days ago, 166 economists, including Harvard economist Jeff Myron, sent a letter to Congress urging them not to pass any bailout at all. The primary reason for this is moral hazard. The standard economic argument is that if you reward, if you give a promise that future actions, no matter how risky, will be bailed out, then this just incentivizes more irresponsible behavior. But this is not the only reason that economic theory might suggest this bailout package is a bad idea. First of all, there's some misconceptions about bankruptcy itself. Wachovia went bankrupt 3 days ago, 2 days ago. It's now owned mostly by Citigroup. What happens in bankruptcy is ownership changes. People who have accounts at Wachovia can still go get money. It's not a doomsday for them. It's absolute loss for the shareholders of Wachovia. Now, this crisis is often referred to as a meltdown. And one thing I hope we all get possibly from this talk that we can agree on is that this is not a heating up. This is a market deep freeze. One of the symptoms that people are most worried about are credit markets where transactions have all but dried up. And in normal times, if there are lots of people who want to borrow money and nobody wants to supply loanable funds, well, the interest rate should rise. That's the reward for people who supply loanable funds. And if the interest rates rise enough, then people who have spare cash should supply this cash, and credit systems should restore to normal. Now, why is the freeze on? And I think I can make the case that it's this announcement of Paulson and Bush and others in the Federal Reserve System that we need action soon, that there will be a deal, that we all agree action is necessary. This talking has created such expectations that it becomes unwise for people, for private agents in the market, to conduct transactions. So what if, for example, the Federal Reserve announced a hamburger bailout program where a share of McDonald's stock will be redeemable by the US government for $200 a share? This morning it was trading at around $60. Well, what would happen? Everybody who wants to buy McDonald's shares thinks that $60 is closer to a reasonable guess about what the future cash flows are worth. But the people who own these things are certainly not going to want to settle for anything less than $200. They can sit on these shares and sell them to the taxpayers of the U.S. for an inflated price. So what happens for the market for McDonald's shares? Well, there are no transactions at all. And this mechanism by which people sitting on paper promises for future cash payments of dubious value, they think they can sell it for an inflated price using our taxpayer dollars, and this gives them a reason not to want to cut the price. We also know from behavioral economics that it's really hard for people to cut the price of the thing that they own when they sell it. One other reason that behavioral economics adds why this thing is a really bad deal is that it tends to reinforce the idea that market competition, individual responsibility are to be applied to people on food stamps and not to people on Wall Street getting corporate welfare. And what we've learned, if there's been any important discovery in economics in the last 20, 30 years in my field, it's that the human being is a reciprocal animal. And if we all learn the lesson that the rules are unfair, that this game is tilted in favor of people with Georgetown and Yale fraternity brother connections and not for the rest of us, then what does that say about my incentive to bet on my ideas, to invest in my education, for me to comply with tax law, for me to supply high effort on the job? If I'm a reciprocal animal, one of the most important actions of economic consequence that our government can possibly do is to take punitive measures.
Thanks, Andy. Professor Dave? I think I can talk loud enough. I agree with a lot of the things that Nathan has been saying. We don't always agree, mind you, but I agree with almost everything Nathan has said. I could go on and on, just like Chetan, about the problem and the remedies and the proposed solution. Let me give you a little historical perspective. A lot of attention has been given to the sell-off in the stock market yesterday, and a lot of worry about stock prices declining so rapidly. And I was watching the television early this morning as I dressed for work, and they were listing some of the major down moves in the stock market over the last 70 or 80 years. And one of the moves was October 19th of 1987, when whatever measure of the stock market you use, the stock market traded off 21-22%. And things became very volatile. But in thinking back on that time, we traded 600 million shares that day, and it was difficult to get confirmation of whether your trade had been executed or not. Yesterday, they traded 6 billion shares. And markets functioned rapidly. Order execution was completed in a very timely manner. The market was incredibly liquid yesterday. We saw a 6 or 7% drop. And yet many investors treated that as a buying opportunity. Today we saw another 6 billion shares trade. And the markets are back up. They're very stable. Equity capital is flowing smoothly. there are worries about a credit meltdown, and yet I think the flow of capital is better than it's ever been. And so I hear worries about a financial meltdown. I don't want to steal Stan's point. He worries about things that regulators know that we don't know. I'm not as worried about things that the regulators know that we don't know. I think there's investment capital out there. The money just didn't go away. There's investment capital out there that I think will be forthcoming to solve problems. And so my perspective is that a great many people thought we'd hit an almost irreversible crisis when the market traded off on October 19th of 1987. 3 months later, the volatility of the markets had largely subsided, and that day was rapidly becoming a thing of distant memory. And I don't know how the current crisis will resolve itself and how it will unfold and how long it will last, but I'm fairly confident that 5 years from now, this won't be the principal crisis on our minds. So that's what I've got to say about it.
Yeah, thank you. 10 years ago, Ted and I wrote a paper on the mortgage market. In that paper, we managed to suggest that there were going to be a lot of foreclosures in the future because of relaxed lending standards, which we were talking about in the paper. Since everyone else has been talking about the bailout plan, my opinion on the bailout plan is not terribly strong. I'm not exactly sure what I would like with this particular bailout plan, and I'm not sure I know enough about it. And I'm sure you'll have questions, and I can speak to those points later. What I thought I might mention in my 2 or 3 minutes is that the cause of the problem is, in fact, mortgages where people are foreclosing, getting foreclosed out of their house in great numbers. Therefore, the assets that have been sold based on the mortgages are worth much less than they had been expected to be. Someone would have held those assets. The investment system has spread it around, and the idea was that was good because it widened who was holding what. What it's appeared to have done is caused lots of different people and organizations, or the banks, which are now together instead of separate, before the investment banks disappeared at least, to all have problems with their mortgage holdings. I'm not sure it would have necessarily been any better if only the banks that gave mortgages were going bankrupt, but they would have had a more intense problem. But it would have been big because what you have to remember is that the housing market and the mortgage market is a gigantic market. It is just tremendously big. And if something goes wrong in a market that big, you know, they used to say, as GM goes, that's how the US goes, because GM and the automobile industry was a big market. But home mortgages and houses, that is a bigger market. It's everyone's biggest investment. It's much bigger than their investment in automobiles. And so it can have problems. What I would suggest is that the problems were due for reasons that are not generally known, just like it's not generally known, a few little facts. I've recently written a chapter for a book that's coming out, and prime mortgages have had exactly the same increase in foreclosures as subprimes, beginning at exactly the same time, and both of them began to increase when housing prices stopped going up. Housing prices started going up when they started having many more people buying houses. So for 25 years, you had a pretty much fixed rate of home ownership, and that went up by a very large amount from about 64% to 69%, which is a 10% increase in a 10-year period, beginning in about 1995. I'm not sure whether or not people care about the causes of this, even though we'll make the same mistake again if we don't understand the causes. What I think happened is people took their eye off the ball of what the qualifications should be for people who were getting mortgages in the first place, and the government is largely responsible for much of that because they wanted home ownership to increase and were willing to play around with the Pandora's box of what the lending requirements were.
So my name is Rachel Croson. I teach a course in behavioral finance, and so I want to talk about a slightly different topic than maybe some of these other people, although Nathan touched a little bit on behaviors. So what I want to talk about is individual economic decision-making and psychological biases, and some areas in which those might have impacts for the current situation. We're backing off from crisis, but the current situation. So I teach a whole semester-long course on this, so I'm not going to come anywhere close to covering everything. But in particular, I want to mention two psychological regularities that I think have important implications for the financial setting today. So the first is a regularity that's sometimes called herding behavior or conformity. And what this means is that people do what other people do, right? So you decide what you want to do, you're not really sure, you look around, you see what other people do, and that's what you do. Conformity is thought to be a major cause of bank runs, right? So for those of you who don't remember, a bank run is when the bank really is itself relatively healthy, but a whole bunch of depositors decide that they want to withdraw their money all at the same time, and that causes the bank to fail. So we've recently seen two pretty major banks fail, right? Washington Mutual a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, which was taken over by JP Morgan, and Wachovia, which was mentioned, which was taken over by Citigroup. Neither of these banks was especially healthy, but neither were either of these banks much more unhealthy than many of the other banks around. But what happened with both of these banks is that the depositors came to the bank and said, we want our money now, today. Right? And this caused a bank run, and this caused the banks to go into bankruptcy. Right? So you see these kinds of psychological biases. The reason these banks are in trouble was not per se because they made bad loans, although they did make bad loans. But lots of people made bad loans and didn't go under. These banks went under because people came to them and said, I want my money. So as was mentioned, on the one hand, this doesn't hurt the people whose money is in the banks, right? You're insured up to $100,000, so those of you who have money in the banks, you're probably okay. But it does hurt the shareholders of the banks. And these shareholders, this is not a normal takeover where the shareholders got to vote and say, yes, we're being paid an appropriate amount based on the going concern of the bank in order to give to sell the company, right? It just got sort of taken out from under. So one implication of what I think is going to happen in the future is that we're going to see, once this this crisis is over, we're going to see a lot more concentration in the banking industry, right? Many banks are going to go under. We're going to see many fewer banks out there. And that, of course, has implications for the kind of competition you see, the kinds of loans that are offered, right, all the normal things that you think about. So the first bias is about herding and conformity. The second bias I want to talk about is about spending and consumption patterns and how people change those patterns as the economy changes or their incomes change. So the first regularity that you see is that it hurts about twice as much to lose a dollar as it feels good to get a dollar. Okay? So when your income goes down by a dollar, that hurts twice as much as you feel good when your income goes up by a dollar. So there are a lot of people in a lot of pain here. Right? Even though this is not a lot of dollars. I mean, it is a lot of dollars, but it's not because it's a lot of dollars. The reason they're in a lot of pain is because of this asymmetry in losses. And the other thing you see when people's incomes go down or their wealth goes down because their housing value has gone down, the first thing they do, of course, is cut back on savings, right? Because savings, after all, is discretionary. And so for many people, again, long term, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, we're going to have a bunch of people who, for a period of time, undersave relative to what they should have or maybe what they were planning on. And so I think there's going to be a long-term consequence because of that. People also cut down on purchases of durable goods, cars, washer dryers, right? Big, chunky purchases. Interestingly, they don't cut back much on what psychologists call small luxuries. Okay? When you go to the Starbucks and you buy yourself a cup of coffee. So maybe people downgrade a little, you know, instead of going to the Starbucks, they'll go to the 7-Eleven to buy the cup of coffee. But they still buy their cup of coffee. And part of this is because they're under a little stress, their jobs are uncertain, other things happen. But generally speaking, people don't cut back on small luxuries when they're in tough times. So this can tell you, for those of you who are still somewhat liquid and actually in the market, what kinds of industries are likely to be what people call recession-proof, or at least recession-resistant. Right? So don't bet on durable goods products, right? Don't bet on cars and washer and dryer machines, right? And you know, maybe even Starbucks is gonna have a tough time, but 7-Eleven's gonna do great. So that's my stock pick.
You wanna try? There we go. Okay, here's the first question. Do you believe that the credit crunch will pose any threat to the availability of student loans?
Go ahead.
So, to an extent, these sorts of events, all that really matters are the least of us. So, for example, students. If banks don't have an incentive to start giving out the money that they have available for loans, that might happen. Now, on the other hand, one thing that the government could do is effectively nationalize the student loan business, if you will, right? So the government uniformly says that if you want to go to college and, you know, blah, 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 here's the loans for it. And number one. Number two, we don't, the term structure of interest rates is going to change. And how that affects the student loan payments is an issue. And I think some of our sort of elite financial folk here might sort of speak a little bit more to that term structure possibly switching. And that, so I personally think that student loans will get affected over the medium run, for sure. And just as a side note with respect to students, historically, whenever there's been a flip of the yield curve, or the term structure of interest rates, as it's known, that's the relationship between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates, there has almost invariably been recessionary periods, right? And that usually means job losses. But more importantly, what that usually means is that students don't necessarily get hired. They're not usually the ones that necessarily get hired. So I think there's two issues here, availability of loans and what do you do when you graduate in order to pay them back, basically.
Follow up or no?
I haven't been following student loans per se. It's Ginnie Mae, isn't it, that handles that? But what I thought I remember reading, and it was like 4 or 5 months ago, it was before the current problems, was they were having their own issues with students not paying them back and having financial difficulties. So based on that, I would think that there'd be a problem, and it's only going to be exacerbated if the economy winds down and has some sort of recession of any real significance and the money's being used for other purposes. So I would suspect that probably there won't be a lot of money flowing. But, you know, it's a political issue and anything can happen.
You're recommending they don't pay back their loans?
But that may be what you should learn from this. The wrong lesson, which is don't pay back and the people who lent to you will be bailed out.
What is the worst case scenario if the government takes no action? What is the probability of the worst case scenario?
Let me make a comment on that, because Nathan will say the same thing that I will, but I honestly think that the possibility of some kind of financial meltdown is fairly small, all right? I really think that there's a lot of investment capital out there. I think that the financial institutions that would potentially go under, I don't think that that's a big issue. Someone else will own them. There are a great many banks that have played this fairly conservatively. I think banks like Wells Fargo and Bank of America are in good shape. I think a great many of the strong foreign competitors are in good shape. There may be some needed changes in regulation to permit the easy flow of capital into the banking sector. But I think those will occur quickly. I think those will be much less controversial than the bailout. So I'm fairly confident, and I think there's investment capital out there to keep solid enterprises operating successfully. So I'm fairly confident.
The two things I worry the most about is a precipitous fall in the value of the dollar and runaway inflation that basically punishes all of us who save money. The good news, though, is I think there are policy tools that have worked before that could be implemented. I mean, one is what we have in food markets for labeling. I mean, if we took off all the labels on the cans of food so you didn't know the nutritional contents of anything in the grocery store, you might buy a few fewer groceries. I think if I didn't think anybody was looking over milk and meat safety, I might buy less of those products. Well, you know, we have rules that say people who build and sell portfolios have to provide information so that the people buying them can read the contents and see what's inside. And we've had legislation under the Bush administration in 2004 and 2005 that have reduced capital requirements and made it easier for firms to be less transparent If we just take the regulators off of a vacation and put them back to work, I think there are lots of reasons to be optimistic.
I've got a particular comment on the probability numbers and so on and so forth. So if, insofar as people are interested, at the University of Pittsburgh and in their Department of Economics, if you go to their website, they actually have a link to a macro forecasting, very simple macro forecasting model. This is exactly the type of things that macro folk care about, this kind of a question, the probability of recession, all that. And you can check out what those estimates are. And by far, it's one of the better frameworks for giving a numerical estimate with respect to downturns in national incomes.
Are there non-regulatory market system schemes that could prevent future crises of this sort?
Yes, it's called bankruptcy. And Sweden, you know, there was, New York Times ran a story recently about bank failures in Sweden, which happened not too long ago. And there are a number of Swedish central bankers that have been in New York in recent days arguing that the best thing is to get the pain over with very quickly, and then we start getting on with the future and all the hope and opportunity it portends.
So I also want to make a point that there are other sources of lending capital than banks and, for that matter, investment banks. So one of the movements, which is very small but it's growing, is peer-to-peer lending. So those of you who've seen Prosper and these other sorts of sites where individuals go on and say, I need $1,000 for my student loan, and other people take, you know, 10 bucks of each of that, right? 100 people loan $10, you pay them back. And so that's, I think, an interesting model. It's not clear it's going to work, yes or no. I don't know that they could have avoided a situation like this by any means. But I suspect that part of what's going to happen is that we're going to see more exploration of these alternative types of mechanisms for generating liquidity.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that certainly we're never going to be able to prevent, say, recessions. Or I'm skeptical, at least. And I'm skeptical that we'll not in the future have major problems that look like they may get very serious and may actually get serious. It's happened in the past. It could happen in the future. The question about can we avoid this, I think this one was avoidable. Because I think that you can sort of pinpoint where it came from, and I think it has to do with the mortgage standards. If there were not the foreclosures and mortgages, we wouldn't have had the financial problems with the banks. We wouldn't have had the so-called toxic instruments, financial instruments that were based on the bank, on the mortgages, and we wouldn't be having the problem we're having now. You know, it doesn't mean something else might not have arisen, but you know, it is due specifically in this case to the mortgages. And I think the government sort of tried to stick its nose in someplace where its motivations may have been good, but the idea was we wanted to broaden home ownership. And the only way, you use several different ways to broaden home ownership. You can just give money to people to buy homes, but that's not one that's likely to be politically all that popular. The other alternative is to try to make it easier for people to get homes. And it became easier for people to get homes, and the government wanted it to become easier. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac wanted it to get easier. The problem is it got so easy that everybody could get a home basically with almost nothing, because you could lie about your income and you didn't have to put any assets down. And the increase in home ownership led to the bubble in the price of homes. People were making a lot of money on houses, and it's very tempting to speculate on an asset which may go up when you don't have to put any money down on the investment. And so that's why I think we are where we are.
Excuse me, I just would like to interject. There's something on the order of 50 million mortgage holders in the U.S., and in normal times, less than 1% of them are late on payments and defaulting, and right now about 3% are. And so that means that 97% of mortgage holders in the U.S. are making their payments. And yes, this is a threefold increase, but to call it a crisis, I'm not really sure that that is the location of the problem, rather than it's the intensely leveraged secondary bets in financial markets that have made this a less tractable problem.
So I just want to pick up on that financial markets business, right? So stabilization policy, which is a major feature of all forms of macro thought and experience and whatnot, comes into play here. Now, Bernanke is one of the very few macroeconomists who has spent his lifetime studying these rare events, shocks in Wall Street affecting Main Street, if you will. Okay, so
one thing one might consider is give the Fed authority for oversight but not regulation for all current financial activities and future financial institutions and whatnot that might sort of crop up. And this is called a forward-looking regulatory contract in macro theory. And it's a rare position to take for people, but it's one way that macroeconomists have argued that you can get forward-looking oversight, not regulations, so in the sense that the Fed is aware of all the new instruments and vehicles being created at all times, right? So they have a presence in some of the larger financial sectors. So
we talked just a moment ago about regulatory response, and I think the equity markets are very liquid, but I think one of the problems that is an unintended consequence of the regulations that have been enacted is that after the Enron bankruptcy several years ago, they rushed quickly to enact the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which has a great many good provisions to it. One of the provisions that they enacted, I think, wasn't as carefully thought out as it needed to be. And I think that if they had taken more time and thought into the future, they could have foreseen that. And so that provision is called mark to market. In principle, marking to market is an extraordinarily good thing. It simply means that when you figure out a bank's capital adequacy or the capital adequacy of any institution subject to regulation, you mark the value of their assets to its market value. That works extraordinarily well for brokerage firms and their individual customers who are borrowing money to buy stock, because stocks are incredibly actively traded. We know their value without question pretty much at the end of every day, with very few exceptions. In fixed income markets, in the markets for corporate bonds, and especially mortgages, that doesn't work so well. And so when you think about the assets on the books of some of these financial institutions, there are two sets of assets. There are some of these exotic mortgage securities. It's very popular to call them toxic. Many of these securities have been structured so that they're taking the remnants of the payments on the mortgages, meaning that those mortgages or those securities are unlikely to pay off because they essentially depend on the people who have already defaulted. Those are the assets that are very likely to be purchased by a government agency in a bailout, the least valuable of all those securities. But there's another important class of assets, and those are the bonds of a great many creditworthy companies, and the components of these mortgage-engineered securities that actually are quite good. All of these securities have been marked drastically down in value, some for good reason, some for not such a good reason. But what happens when these institutions become illiquid is they have to sell these securities into a very thin market. The price drops a bit, and because that's the market value, the capital of other institutions is then marked down. They face liquidity issues, and when they go to sell, they have to sell the instruments which are actually of the best quality and the most liquid. And when those instruments meet few buyers, prices are marked down further. Now, I don't want to come across as being against mark to market. I don't know what the right solution is. I think mark to market is basically a good thing. And yet one of the things we want to remember is that there is a bit of a liquidity problem out there. It is attributable in part to the way they're imposing a regulation that probably wasn't as well thought out as it could have been. There probably needed to be some kind of safety valve on that. And so I think the lesson to be drawn from that is not to rush too quickly to any kind of regulatory fix to the problem that we're in right now, and to think carefully to buy as much time as possible before imposing some kind of regulation that could have unintended consequences, not only for the short run, but for the long run.
Can I just say, hopefully, something quickly? We don't really know the details of the bailout plan. And so it's hard to really be able to say whether what the impacts are going to be. It really depends to some extent on the prices they're paying for these essentially mortgage-based instruments vis-a-vis the real worth. It could be the case that the really bad instruments get sold at really good prices, which is a really good deal for the people selling them, and a really bad deal for the taxpayers. Or it could be that it's more reasonable and they somehow figure out a way to pay something closer to a more realistic and market-type price, but in which case it doesn't help the people who own the instruments all that much. And so it's sort of a tricky issue, and we don't have any of those details worked out, so it's hard to really know. I also wanted to just say that my two colleagues to my right aren't really to my right in a metaphorical sense. But in this case, they actually are somewhat, because I presume, and I could be wrong, that there's a lot we don't know. And I have a very high opinion of Ben Bernanke, the guy who's head of the Fed, as hopefully you know. He thinks there's a problem. The depression is his expertise. I don't consider him an unreasonable guy. So on that basis, I would give him the benefit of the doubt and hope that they craft something that's not too terrible and say, okay, I would go along with it. But from what I've seen so far, if I didn't have Bernanke there, I would probably say I'm against it. But it's hard to have a really strong opinion when you don't know exactly what they're really planning to do. I mean, it was a 3-page piece of paper as they were talking about it, and this is a big, complicated issue that we're going to be talking about. So it's the details that are important to a large extent, and we don't know those details.
And lack of details is a good reason to be against the plan.
There's a lot of questions in here about bailout. A couple that might be a little bit different. If there's a bailout, how does it affect the budget? I'm told, or I've heard, it's not like a traditional expenditure like funding the war, but something different. Do we know what that would be?
So I actually want to make one sort of minor correction about bailout. So people are now starting not to call this a bailout, but to call this a buyout. Because what, at least in the most recent 3-page version, what was happening is that the government was putting up a bunch of money, but they were getting an equity stake in these companies that they were bailing out, right? So you would actually then, the government, sort of the taxpayer slash through the government, would then own the stock of these companies, and if indeed, as some people on this panel are suggesting, things are really hunky-dory and it will all return to normal just fine, then presumably you'll get your money back when things all return to normal. So I think thinking about this as a charity kind of thing, that we're just handing off money and getting nothing in return, is not quite an accurate perception. So where they're getting the money from, where are they getting the money from?
So, well, so here's the thing, right? So with respect to the national budget, this probably will not be any form of a line item or anything. What we're looking at is a possibility for recapitalization, right? So getting that equity stake. Now, a lot of money has fled to U.S. Treasury bonds and so on and so forth, right? So, I mean, those yields are ridiculously low now and so on and so forth. It is feasible that Paulson, with a little bit of arm twisting and whatnot, can generate, especially given this authority to spend, in order to buy out an equity stake and whatnot. In that particular case, this form of recapitalization typically does not show up in the U.S. government, sort of the official budgets, that is, right? Once again, from the macro perspective, which you're buying out possibly equity that is really bad, all the moral hazard issues that have been raised, which is sort of quite important. So in terms of the real cost, once the economy has worked through whatever it needs to work through, that might still be present, but it's not necessarily showing up as a line item. So. Oh, it's, well, they actually effectively...
They sell bonds.
Yeah, they basically sell bonds, right? So the credit card limit on the national government got raised by a trillion and some a few months ago when Paulson sort of requested that authority, or that debt ceiling to go up, so...
And if they buy pieces of paper whose intrinsic value is $60 for $200 each, this is a charity gift from the U.S. taxpayers straight into the hands of the shareholders of these companies.
Question, depends on the price, right?
Yes, but he also made the point that if they pay a fair price, then it's not helping them out, because if it's a fair price, why isn't somebody in the private sector already buying it off their hands? Paulson has even said that part of the rescue mission will involve being on the generous side, which means paying above the intrinsic value for these securities.
Everything I've seen says that they're going to pay way over market value. When you hear them discussing the prices that will be paid as part of the, quote, rescue or whatever you want to call it, I call it a bailout. They're going to pay something that they refer to as the hold to maturity value for these securities. Basically, what hold to maturity value assumes is that you will buy the securities, that you will hold them to their maturity, and that you will receive all of the promised cash flows. First of all, they will not receive all of the promised cash flows from the securities that are likely to be dumped into this pool, okay? The second point is they probably plan to compute what economists and finance people refer to as the present value of the cash flows, meaning we ask, what would we have to invest today at a certain interest rate for that amount invested today to grow to the promised value tomorrow? They are very likely to assume a relatively low rate in the valuation of these securities, which will assign an unrealistically high value to the securities, even if you are going to get all the promised cash flows. So I probably want to use the same kind of inflammatory terms as Nathan in referring to what I think is about to happen. I think it amounts to printing money. I think it will, in the long run, be highly inflationary. And so that's my thoughts on the matter, even though we don't know the detail of precisely what they're proposing. But at least under the original proposal, they had broad latitude to buy bad credit card loans, to buy bad student loans, to actually buy homes in foreclosure and knock them down to increase the price of the existing residential real estate stock. I don't think destroying assets worked during the Great Depression of the 30s. I'm inclined to think it's not going to work if they're allowed to implement the procedure in the future.
Do you think we're in a recession now?
Yes. That's called my Joe Biden answer, right? So, yes.
And what do you think we should do about it?
So the textbook definition is obviously the wrong definition for a recession, right? Because it says two successive quarter decreases in real GDP. That's not, well, because the actual definition of the recession is set out by the NBER, right? And that's part of the information they use in order to define backward looking whether we're in a recession or not, right? Including some 100-odd leading economic indicators. And it's not entirely clear whether from recession to recession they've used the same set of indicators to define whether we were in a recession or not, right? But as far as unemployment's going up, that's going up, right? So we've seen that taking place, which is probably the most relevant part of a recession. GDP has been surprisingly resilient, which is great, right? I mean, it hasn't tanked, basically, which is quite fantastic. But the fact of the matter is, unemployment's going up. And if we look at the distribution of who is losing jobs, that's probably the most important thing. So there is a group of us macroeconomists who would basically define recessionary periods as consistent increases in the unemployment rate, and specifically in certain types of unemployment. And we pretty, in order to say a non-inflammatory answer, I'd pretty much have to see a services report, next year's service sector report, in order to solidify.
Can I just say something? The problem with using the word recession is that it's black and white. It's yes or no.
Exactly.
And it's more informative to say, are we in a slowdown? And I'm not sure anybody here would disagree with the fact that we're in a slowdown.
Yeah.
But as slowdowns go, so far, the unemployment rate's going up, but it's not terribly high. GDP has been not doing great, but it's not doing terrible as relative to other periods in the past where we've had stronger slowdowns. Now, the problem that's brought about these proposals by the government is the claim that we're going to have a very severe slowdown. That's the only justification for the type of changes they're suggesting and government intervention in the market. And if you really believe we're going to head into a really big slowdown, something maybe not as bad as the Great Depression, but something on the order of that. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, unemployment was 25% during the Great Depression. I mean, this is big time stuff. That would justify it if you think we're heading in that direction. Right now, if you didn't have all the headlines going on and you just looked at the real economy, you wouldn't have any evidence to indicate that we're heading towards, you know, the end of the world. But doesn't mean we're not.
Good economist answer.
Why has the U.S. crisis caused a worldwide financial crisis?
Everything that happens in the U.S. has a worldwide impact, right? Lots of people hold U.S. dollars. Lots of people hold U.S. bonds in other places, right? Our economy is inextricably linked with other economies. And to some extent, the problems that that we're facing are due to the sort of increased sophistication around financial assets, not just mortgage assets, but lots of different assets, which has also been seen in other countries. So although they're not having the same housing bubble and crash kind of problems that we're having, they're having their similar issues.
Well, actually, I just came from Europe. I came back yesterday. They have had a housing bubble in many of the countries in Europe, and they're experiencing some of the same problems we're having. They also do hold a fair amount of our mortgage-based assets. And the banks that have gone under there tend to be banks that have invested fairly heavily in our mortgage-backed assets, which really are causing a lot of problems.
Categorize these a little bit, but seems like we've talked about problems and what not to do, but what about solutions as what should we do?
We could have a vote of the panel to see whether they're in favor of the unknown bailout plan, but other than that, I don't know.
So one quick place to go is to look what our Congress did after the savings and loan crisis in the 80s and 90s. And there were actually a lot of laws that many of us regard as fairly good regulations that were targeted specifically at avoiding a mortgage market crisis. And it was only through systematic undoing of those rules and systematic lightening of reporting requirements, lessening of capital requirements, there were people inside many of these banks writing bad loans that were making noise inside the bank saying, these people aren't going to pay us back. And the managers would say, it doesn't matter. We're going to sell it in 2 weeks to somebody on Wall Street who will repackage it. So the incentives really got so far on the other side of these otherwise sensible rules. So one can make the case that simply enforcing the rules that were put in place after the savings and loan crisis would get us a long way toward the kind of faith among all the participants in the market.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one of the other groups that hasn't been mentioned, which deserves some blame, which is the rating agencies. Mm. We had these financial instruments based on these mortgages, which were relatively new. There wasn't much history going back. The rating agencies gave, we now know, ex post, ratings that were way too high for those instruments and have paid almost no penalty as far as I can tell. Normally, if you make a bad prediction like that, people are going to go elsewhere. Part of the problem there was that the government had said there are three rating agencies and only three rating agencies, and no one else is allowed to be an official rating agency for various other investments that some of our financial institutions are making that have to be AAA, and the idea of what's AAA is set by these three rating agencies. Now, it's not clear what you do to keep them from making the mistake that they made in the past, but somehow we have to find a way of punishing them for doing a bad job. That's what usually happens in markets. So they're more careful. They should have said, we don't have much in the way of history with these. We'll give them a tentative rating, but we don't really know what's going to happen. But instead, they gave them these ratings as if they knew how they were going to perform.
I got three questions like this. Basically, you're a risk taker. got $50,000 or more. Where are the opportunities now? Endowed chair in economics, UTD.
Small luxuries. So, right, that's the answer. Firms that smell small luxuries, a little downscale. So one of the things that happens when the economy slows down is people stop shopping at Neiman Marcus. The people who used to shop at Neiman Marcus go to Macy's. People who used to shop at Macy's go to Target. Right?
That's for people who want to do well, but they're not the big risk takers. If you're a big risk taker, you put your money into home builders, and you put your money into banks, bank stocks. There are, you know, funds that have this as a home building fund that you can get. And, you know, if you're really a risk taker, there's a big upside potential because they're pretty low.
You know, if you look at the history of stock market returns for the last 80 or 90 years, we usually measure risk in terms of the standard deviation of the yearly return for the stock market. The historic average is about 20% per year if you look at the variability of the actual returns. If you look at the options market and you look at the prices of options, you can gauge where the market thinks the level of risk is, all right? If you go back and you look at the stock market crash of 1987, volatility rose far above the historic norm of 20% to a short run value of about 80%. If you look at the post 9/11 period, when markets were very volatile, it got up to around 40% for the Standard & Poor's 500. And it's up at around 38% now. My view is that what that's telling you is that you're going to be paid to be taking risks. And you can pick individual stocks if you want. I like certain industrial companies. But I think the really smart thing to do if you're an investor is be diversified. Invest in the U.S. economy. And so there are good ways to do like that, like the exchange-traded funds that track the S&P 500. If you want to be a bit more aggressive, you can buy a total market index. But in my mind, it's time to step out and have confidence right now. There's a lot of research that says you can't pick the tops and the bottoms. Things can get worse, but they can also get better, and they can get better in a hurry. That's not to say they will. But I think the answer is not to try to pick individual stocks in a really tricky market like this unless you've got some experience. And I think the thing to do is step forward and be paid for taking some risk by buying the overall market. Maybe not investing all of your $50,000, but going in $20,000 today, going in $20,000 in 3 months, and the rest a little later. So that would be my thought on the matter.
Not very risky. Yeah. Not very risky. Hedging is always good advice. Hedging and diversification is always good advice.
There's questions about the international influence on kind of both sides. Does foreign investing in American markets have anything to do with this? And do foreign institutions have anything to do with coming out of this? Is sort of the way it characterizes these set of questions.
The obvious answer to me is yes. I heard a statistic recently that in the last 8 years, for every dollar of new GDP, there's been $5 of new credit created. And this is just unsustainable if credit is being expanded faster than our income. We can't go on like this for long. That means we've been consuming, having a party, by borrowing money from foreigners. Lots of us know this. Therefore, their claims on our future income are intimately linked with our financial futures. So interlinked is about as specific, though, as I think one can get due to the murkiness of all the details. Do you have?
So I have an opinion on the international thing. So my understanding is that there are certain limits on the extent to which foreigners can come and basically buy up assets and whatnot on Wall Street, right? I mean, it's like, what, 10% is the maximum that one of the princes of Saudi Arabia is allowed to spend using sovereign wealth funds and whatnot to, right? So there are limits on that. I don't see why those limits cannot be increased, right? I mean, we've just witnessed possibly one of the greatest wealth transfers, like, in the history of economic man, or at least macroeconomic man, recently. And if they want to come in and buy here, I don't understand why there are restrictions. So, I mean, that's sort of a, I think that's an issue internationally is concerned. Too many Canadians.
Yeah, I read a not totally facetious article recently that was suggesting that since the problem is that we have too many houses relative to the affordable demand, we should convince foreigners that they can get a great deal coming to the United States buying houses, taking care of that demand. And I think this was Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal. Now, he's also pretty funny sometimes, but he actually seems sort of serious about that. And that would help stop the housing decline in prices, at least. Is the question in general, if the way I interpreted it was, can we blame foreigners for this problem? Are they doing something with the stock market that's causing it to go crazy? And I don't know that we have any particular information, but it's certainly no reason to think, I think, that anything like that's going on.
Okay, we're out of time completely. I thank you for coming, and I really thank the panel for taking the time. To meet with you.